Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
On Monday, this.
All right, let's get to breaking news now. Billionaire hedge fund manager Jeffrey Epstein is under arrest tonight on sex trafficking charges.
According to court documents, the FBI seized a vast trove of lewd photographs of young-looking women or girls during a search over the weekend.
Federal prosecutors allege that between 2002 and 2005, Epstein paid underage girls as young as 14 hundreds of dollars to massage him or have sex with him at his townhouse in New York City or his mansion in Palm Beach, Florida.
Epstein has surrounded himself with a high-profile circle of friends, including then-private citizen Donald Trump, Prince Andrew, and former President Bill Clinton, who reportedly took more than two dozen trips on Epstein's private jet between 2001 and 2003.
Though the national media are all over the Epstein indictment this week, the story didn't just happen overnight. In fact, it's been hanging around like a bad smell for years. Our WNYC colleague and host of Here's the Thing, Alec Baldwin, picks up the narrative.
Last year, Julie Brown of the Miami Herald conceived, reported, and wrote one of the most explosive criminal justice stories in recent memory. She tracked how the U.S. Justice Department shut down an FBI investigation that may have been on the verge of discovering the full extent of a child sex trafficking operation run by billionaire Jeffrey Epstein. The U.S. attorney in charge of that case was none other than Alex Acosta, now the United States Secretary of Labor under Donald Trump. As punishment for recruiting underage girls to perform sex acts at his Palm Beach mansion, Epstein spent barely a year in the local lockup with a liberal daily work release. Julie Brown found many, many more victims who had not spoken up and revealed the extent of Acosta's capitulation in the face of Epstein's high-powered defense lawyers. For her crucial work, she's been given a Polk Award for Justice Reporting. While she was in New York to receive it, she joined me on stage at WNYC's Greenspace. Thank you so much for coming. Describe for people, who is Epstein? And what was he charged with? And what was the eventual outcome of the prosecution that Acosta oversaw?
Right. Well, he was a billionaire financier. And
he had a hedge fund.
He had a hedge fund, and he dabbled in a lot of other financing things. Like at one point, he wanted to take over Pan Am Airlines. There was a lot of different projects that he invested money in, and he made a lot. Obviously, made a lot of money. He owned two jets, and he owned homes in New Mexico, the largest single residence here in Manhattan, home in Palm Beach, home in Paris. So he was extremely wealthy. Very smart. You know, he was a mathematician and Nobel Prize-winning scientists were in his circle.
He grew up where, in New York?
He grew up in New York. He didn't finish college, but he ended up getting a job at the Dalton School teaching mathematics. Mm-hmm. And there, through the students' parents, he ended up working for Bear Stearns.
Bear Stearns.
And he sort of left under mysterious circumstances there and then opened his own, financial firm.
And during the course of the trial, was it exposed or was it revealed how long he'd been doing this activity with young girls?
No.
Was it assumed he'd been doing this ongoing
yes,
for some period of time?
Yes, and he had people right. helping him.
Right.
It was very organized.
Right. Describe the operation. We're in Palm Beach. Like he's got a big house there.
It was like something if you saw a movie about it, you would think, oh, yeah, right, this is really going to happen. But it's exactly what he did. He had a lot of money, and he had a lot of people around him, and what he liked massages. So what he would do is he had people go out to various areas.
Malls.
Well, initially it was like spas. Like, in fact, one of the women that he recruited was from Mar-a-Lago, which is right around the corner from his home in Palm Beach. And once he got his hold on of a couple of the girls, what he would say to them is, you bring me a couple more girls and I'll give you the same amount of money. So right. he would be paying them.
So they were paid for services.
Yes, for massages.
For massages. And then they were paid as recruiters to bring in more people.
Right. And the recruiters would recruit more, and it just went on and
like
on.
Like a pyramid.
Right.
And it kept growing and growing until it got to be, by your estimation, how many young women were coming in and out of that house over time?
I mean, it had
hundreds?
To be over 100 at least. At least,
and they got them at, like, if I read correctly, in shopping malls and different
places. Yeah, because what happened was once he got his foothold into one of the high schools there, one girl would tell another girl. And these were girls who came from, you know, most people think of Palm Beach as everybody's wealthy, but there really is, West Palm Beach is a very struggling blue-collar area, and there were girls who lived in vulnerable situations where they were in one step away from homelessness. You know, the other thing is he sort of led them to believe that he was going to help them out of their misery.
Right.
You know, like, you're beautiful, I'll get you.
Connect them in some way, modeling,
and
acting.
Yeah, and he had
nonsense.
He had people, you know. I have people, that kind of thing. And he did.
But he did know some people.
And actually some of them did, a couple of them did become actresses, you know.
Right.
And so he had some contacts, and he led a lot of them to believe that I'm going to get you out of this. And
I don't think if any of those actresses won an Oscar, they would thank Jeffrey Epstein in their acceptance speech.
Probably not.
But,
probably not.
Did other victims come forward who wanted to make charges against Epstein for events that predated Palm Beach?
Yes, but the problem is the statute of limitations. So there's quite a number of girls in that category, and there's really not a lot they can do because.
Were his activities in that regard confined to Palm Beach, or did he
no.
do it in New York and?
From the women that I interviewed, he did it everywhere. He had an island in the Caribbean. He would send one of the girls, or probably more than one, but one that I know of who I interviewed, out to, for example, he had the island, so they would take a ferry or a helicopter from St. Thomas. What she told me was we would go to the nightclubs in St. Thomas, and I would just bring him more girls. And there was Sarah Kellen, who
That's
was a scheduler.
Right. What did she schedule?
She scheduled the girl.
So did you interview her?
No, she hasn't spoken to anybody. And she got immunity under the non-prosecution agreement that he worked out.
Right. The person you did interview, who was a recruiter for him, how did they strike you? What did they? Was it a man or a woman?
Well, you know, remember, a lot of the girls were recruiters for him,
right.
too. And so they, you know, it's very sad to think about how this changed their lives. Imagine being 14 years old and, you know, you basically don't have any place to live, and you start doing this and you're 14 and, you know, now you're 30 and you look back on it, and it's very painful to watch how much they blame themselves. They're very ashamed, and they blame themselves for the other girls that they brought into it.
Paint a picture, if you will, of who Epstein you think is, and why did he do this? I mean, because apparently, if I'm not mistaken, he had women coming in and out of the house, and he was having sex with multiple women a day.
Yes.
Like three times a day sometimes, correct?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
What kind of a picture did you get of him?
Well, obviously he had some kind of an illness
right.
to be doing something like that. And I think that the biggest thing that I came across from reading everything and all the research that I did was he really felt that he was above the law. He just seemed to know from the get-go that he was going to get away with it. He pressured, intimidated, bullied, hired the best lawyers that his money could buy. And when those lawyers didn't give him what he wanted, he hired more lawyers. He hired politically connected people. He pressured the girls. He hired private investigators who followed their parents. He deposed the girls and got her medical records saying that she had had abortions, called her parents who were Catholic, and asked her Catholic parents, what do you think?
So the goal was to attack the victims.
Oh, yes. And not only just the victims, actually. The police who had been investigated were followed. The prosecutors were pressured. And I think that's what makes this a story, really, is every step of the way with the criminal justice system, he powered his way through to basically get away with
it. Now, some of the people that you, like Starr, for example, I was kind of taken aback because, of course, here's Starr, who made his reputation going after Clinton for sex crimes.
Right.
And here he's defending Epstein. But with people like Dershowitz and Lefcourt and Starr, what do you think was, what else do you think was behind it, if anything?
Here's the big thing about it. They didn't care about the girls. They felt these were throwaway girls. These were prostitutes.
That's essentially what was Epstein's defense, correct? Which he said, they came as prostitutes. They were there for a reason. I paid them. If you want to get me on a prostitution rap, that's one thing.
Right.
But to say I was involved in sex trafficking, which is what they try to do, he said, that's not accurate. Right. He wanted to contend that that they knew why they were there. They knew they were there to get paid for sex. And that he also, if I'm not mistaken, you can highlight this for us, that he tried to explain that he told everybody, don't bring me anybody here who's underage. And he thought all of them were of age. Is that correct?
Yes. But, I mean, the women that I interviewed who were involved in it, one of whom, by the way, was involved in it for years, said that he made it very clear he didn't want anybody who was older. All he wanted was young girls. And the younger, the better. I mean, that's basically what he always told them. The younger, the better. But, of course, you know, this is what they say. And he and his lawyers, I'm sure, would say that they're lying and that that was not the case.
Describe for everyone what happens in the case involved with Acosta in order to arrive at the decisions they arrived at, or the plea agreement they arrived at.
Well, the state prosecutors in Palm Beach first had the case. The police brought it to them. And within a very short time, all these lawyers that Epstein had hired began to pressure the state prosecutor to make the case go away. And essentially, the state prosecutor was ready to make it go away. And really, he was going to get anything except a misdemeanor. And the police chief, to his credit, said, wait a minute, this isn't going to happen. Because at the time this was happening, more and more girls, every time they enter, keep in mind, since it was a sex pyramid scheme, you would interview one girl, and the one girl would say, well, these two girls brought me. And then they go to those two girls, and they would say, these two girls. So they were getting an avalanche of girls. And here you have the state prosecutor saying, oh, we're just going to let him off on a misdemeanor. And the chief, to his credit, and the lead detective said no, and they went to the FBI. So then it became a federal case, and Alexander Acosta was the U.S. attorney in Miami at the time. And
appointed by George W. Bush.
Yes, it was the Bush administration. It was Republican administration. Now, Epstein was very much of a Democrat, and he had supported Clinton and a lot of other Democratic causes. But he was smart. It was a Republican administration, so what do? You hire a Republican lawyer. So
Starr.
Ken Starr, you know, Lefcourt. And also the other connection was Acosta had worked in the same politically very important law firm of Kirkland and Ellis, which was the same law firm that Starr worked for and Lefcourt worked for. And so what they immediately started doing was try to work out some kind of a plea agreement with him, almost from the get-go, even though the FBI was on a parallel course to charge him with sex trafficking, and they were getting more and more information. And but so there were two kind of things happening. One was the FBI was really going full steam ahead with trying to prosecute him, and then you had the prosecutors who were essentially sending emails back and forth saying, well, why don't we charge him with this, or can we charge him with that? And it was this sort of collegial thing going on between the prosecutors.
So, they were asking defense attorneys almost like, would you mind if we charge him with this?
Yeah, sort of.
They really, I mean, from what I read, and I'm not an expert on this, I've rarely observed such deference by prosecutors to the subject of a crime.
Yeah.
I mean, in the modern world.
And what was amazing about the whole thing is, if you follow the whole thing, which this took me over a year and a half to do, to follow the sequence of events here, is that they would fight down and say, okay, we're going to charge him with this, and then he'd say, okay, we're going to do it. And then he'd look at it and go, no, I want a better deal than that. Then they'd start all over. And they manipulated, he manipulated the criminal justice system like I've never seen before, because every time they got him, which was a pretty good deal, he would say, well, it's still not good enough. Go back again. Florida State prisons, I can tell you, because I covered them for years.
That's where their troubles begin.
They're vicious, you know. But he managed to work it out so that he would go to the Palm Beach County Jail. He had his own private little wing. And it didn't just end there. I mean, he had his driver pick him up every morning.
Well, we explained about the work release thing.
Yeah, he got work released. Now, sex offenders in Florida don't get Right. Work release.
And the work release was what? He was out, what I read was he was out for 12 hours a day.
6 days a week.
6 days
a week. His driver picked him up, took him to his nice waterfront office in West Palm Beach. And, you know, they did have sheriff's deputies, you know, standing outside the office. But they were outside the office. And on the inside of the office, people were coming and going all day, including women coming to visit him. I interviewed one of these deputies. And I said, well, did you even pay attention to what he was doing in the office? You know, he had girls in there. And he goes, oh, no, that was not our job.
I have a picture of you, though. Were you sitting at a kitchen? I mean, I'm going to be very melodramatic now, but were you sitting at a kitchen table at the end of some days and just staring at a, you know, a cup of tea or something and saying, you know, you just couldn't believe, not just that this happened, but and not that just that it was covered up, but the way that it was covered up. And this is so insidious how this was done.
Yeah.
They gave this guy like he went to camp for a while, like an extended trip to camp.
Yeah, and with everything that I uncovered little by little, you know, it's like peeling away an onion. And I get so tired because it's a lot of dense court documents.
Right.
You know, 10,000 probably records. I mean, just so much. And it's a lot of it is so, it's all legalese and I'm not a lawyer and trying to make heads or tails out of it. I would just get so tired.
And you
tired.
Brought up a very good point backstage, which you said, the Herald, like other newspapers, are not wealthy organizations and institutions anymore. So this money meant a lot. They had to spend a lot of dough to do this legwork, correct?
Yeah, yeah, they invested a lot of money into this. They believed in me.
Was there a Ben Bradley there in your story?
Yeah, it was Casey Frank. I have to give him, he's my editor, who actually even went to bat with me. The police chief did not want to go public. He had never gone public with this before. He had been also, you know, his career was, because he went after Epstein too, his career was hurt by it. And
how so?
Well, a lot of people went after him, you know, and...
Is he still the police chief?
No, he retired.
But he wasn't taken out of office, removed.
No, but it became hard for him to be the police chief. Quite frankly, the reason why he didn't want to talk to me, he said he had talked to a lot of reporters off the record and sort of told them where to go and nothing ever happened. He was convinced that a lot of media had squashed this story. And he was really at the point where he was fed up and didn't want to talk to any media anymore. And so I said, we're not going to do it. And he said, no, somebody's going to call your publisher. And the next thing you know, you're going to be assigned to the OBIT department. So I said, no, you know, talk to my kid. So Casey called him up and told him.
Is that the game show host of the journalism department, the OBIT department?
Yeah, exactly. That's about it. Yeah.
Okay. Like, what was the part that really just made you go, oh, my God, it was really, among many things that were the most disturbing?
I think it was the fact that the government, now think about, you know, we know about the abuse in the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church protected the priests. And we know about the abuse with the Olympic gymnast, the university had protected this doctor. But this was our government, even after they knew what he had done. Biggest thing that drove me was how they continued to fight these girls after they filed this crime victims' rights lawsuit. It was almost like they were Epstein. The government was in Epstein's camp.
They were his counsel.
Yeah, and they were saying, we're not giving you these documents. We're not going to tell you what we did.
Right, like defense attorneys.
And that just, I mean, how do you do that? How in good conscience do you do that?
What can we do to help protect young women from this kind of sexual abuse?
Well, there's a lot of different things. I think our law enforcement agencies, police officers, prosecutors especially, need to be better trained to handle these kinds of cases. There's a whole different way you handle trauma victims. You can't treat them like just any other victim. They're in a different category because trauma does things to your brain, and it makes it so that you react to things differently. I mean, there's a whole science behind trauma. And so a lot of law enforcement people don't know how to question victims who are victims of sexual assault. They expect that they're going to go ask them a question, and when they hesitate, you know, or they're not consistent in some of the answers, that they're unreliable witnesses. But I've interviewed FBI experts who have made their careers in this, and they said that actually you should expect that their memories are not going to be consistent. And if they are consistent, that's a sign that maybe they aren't telling the truth, because the consistency is that they suffer from trauma and they won't remember exactly every detail the same way, because that's the way your brain is. I've been through some trauma, and there are things in my life that I can't remember. I mean, I'll never remember. You have to have law enforcement people who are really trained to understand that. And there's a whole, like I said, there's a whole science behind it.
Do we have any questions from the audience, from our guests? Have you got the mic here? Right over
Thank
here?
Thank you. Yeah. I just wanted to ask if you had received any pressure similar to the people involved in the case to not continue the investigation, to not publish the article?
I wouldn't phrase it that way, but let's put it this way. There's a lot of people who have been pretty aggressive with trying to discredit me in certain ways. I'm pretty tough. There are countless journalists that are killed all over the world for fighting for the truth and for democracy. There are countless journalists right now being tortured in prisons all over the world. And so anybody that every time that question comes up, of course, you think about it in the back of your head, but I always think about all the other journalists out there that are just really risking their lives every single day.
Over here.
Thank you. I have two questions. First is, did you have a chance to interview him? And second question is, what happened to this woman now? What are they doing in life? And if you touch with them and interview again?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I tried several times. I went to his house when I knew he was there, knocked on the door, wrote letters to him, certified letters, wrote certified letters to his lawyers, reached out to people that I knew him, but no. I just thought I was this little reporter from the Miami Herald that wasn't, just like any other reporter, just doing another rehash of the case. So I don't think he felt that he had to respond to me, and that's just my guess. I still stay in touch with the girls, and I was really touched. They were very young. Some never even told their families that this happened. One of the girls in that category who shared her story to me was scared to death about how her grandparents would read the story. And after the piece came out, she called me and she said that her grandparents had went to her and said that they were really proud of her. I'm sorry, but that made me really touched because it takes a lot of courage to do that. She was really worried about what they would think of her. A lot of the girls, I'm sure, feel that way. And like I said, they feel really ashamed. They really punish themselves. A lot of them didn't turn out well. Some of them are dead. They've overdosed. Some of them became strippers and, or were victims of violence, addicts. The one girl I interviewed her the first time I interviewed her. She was in prison. She was serving a longer term for selling drugs than he served for molesting underage girls.
That's amazing. I want to go over to this side.
I want to get back to the safety of journalists. What concerns, if any, do you have about your own personal safety? I want to know what you do, what locks you have, what the security is.
Well, for a long time, I had a nice loud dog when I was covering the Florida prison system, and there were some people that would show up, lurking outside my... And the dog would, it was so loud, it was my daughter's dog. So now my daughter has her dog back, so I'm thinking maybe I should get another dog. But... I don't really think about it until people ask me, then I get worried. You just keep doing your job.
Well, we live in New York, so we think you're from Florida automatically. You carry a gun, don't you?
Yeah. Well, I've had, I have a lot of friends who are police officers. In fact, my ex-husband is a police officer, and they've all advised me that I should have one, but I just can't bring myself to do it. Like I said, I grew up in Philly, and, you just pay attention to where you're going and what you're doing. Look, if anybody really wants to get you, they're going to get you.
I can't argue with that.
If they really want you.
We're going to finish. We didn't call you. I'm sorry. We're going to finish with you, sir. Go ahead.
What do we know specifically about the relationship between Epstein and Clinton?
He was absolutely on Epstein's plane. It's been documented that he's
going
on his plane.
Where?
South Africa. Epstein donated some money to the Clinton Foundation, and during this time period, which was, I think, the early 2000s, you know, they were, the AIDS epidemic was spreading in Africa, and there was a, you know, a sort of a fact-finding plane trip that Epstein took Clinton on. Now, he went on his plane more than that, though. We know that there was probably like 20 trips. And, you know, of course, a lot of people suspect that maybe he was involved in some way. He's denied that he was involved, and the one girl that we know was very much involved, underage girl, Virginia Roberts, said that she never saw him with any
undergirls. So no woman has come forward.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct.
Well, I was going to say I could talk about sex trafficking all night long, but I think I've had about enough of that subject for now, and we're out of time. But I want to say that, you know, journalists who do the job you're doing are heroes, and I admire you very, very much. Yeah, please. I admire you tremendously for what you've done. Thank you to my guest, Julie Brown from the Miami Herald. And thank you all for coming. Thank you.
On the next On the Media, we'll be addressing the numbing effect of waves and waves of miserable news, and exploring some possible solutions. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.